Hi guys, and welcome to the Hollywood Outsider. You may notice that this opening sounds a little different than the opening you're used to, probably because I'm not emphasizing this as much as I normally do. But this is a special edition of our show. Our regular episode is going to be up every Thursday as always and available at thehollywoodoutsider.com, iTunes, or Stitcher Radio. For this episode, we're going to go inside the movie with the director and producer of the new film, The Projectionist. And for those of you unaware, The Projectionist is an independent film that stars Rush Russo as PTSD-afflicted war veteran Jacob Nix. Now, Jacob spends his nights as a projectionist in a small downtown theater while everything in his life comes crashing down around him. The film tackles themes such as addiction, isolation, and basically the fragile trappings of the human mind. It's shot primarily in black and white. It's got a real cool 40s noir feel to it, and it's got a very memorable score as well. You can hear Brian in my review of the film itself on episode 129 of The Normal Show, or you can read my review on the website. Again, that's thehollywoodoutsider.com. But before you do that, listen to our exclusive interview with writer-director Ryan Kennedy and producer Atit Shah as they both discuss what went into creating the film, the ups and downs of independent filmmaking, as well as their new approach to releasing their movie to you, the audience. Of course, you can always find out more about the movie itself at theprojectionistmovie.com. That's theprojectionistmovie.com. But without further ado, here's our interview with The Projectionist director, Ryan Kennedy, and producer Atit Shah. Enjoy, guys. Well, this is The Hollywood Outsider, and this is a special Inside the Movie edition of our show, as Brian and I are going to talk about the film The Projectionist. And joining us today are producer Atit Shah and writer-director Ryan Kennedy. Our normal episode will release on Thursday, as always. This is Aaron Peterson. Brian Williams, you with me?
Yeah, buddy. Glad to be here.
Now let's meet our guests, and I want to make sure you introduce you guys clearly so we can differentiate between the two of you. Atit, how are you doing?
I'm well, Aaron. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Ryan, how are you doing?
I'm great, thank you.
Now, before we get into the movie itself, is it all right if we talk about you guys for a minute?
Sure.
Okay. Now, Ryan, growing up in Georgia, which Brian as well is from, I can't imagine you having much of a window into the Hollywood industry, even on the outskirts of Atlanta. So I want to know, how did you know this is what you want to do?
You're absolutely right. I really had practically no exposure whatsoever to the film world. I was able to spend some, you know, substantial time in New York in my teenage years. However, the only real kind of exposure I had to cinema was my grandfather was a union projectionist for many, many years. So obviously, he kind of helped, I guess, grew my my love or passion for cinema. But it was always on a very, you know, just simply kind of consumer type of level. I never really thought that it was a possibility that I could actually do this for a living. You know, it wasn't anything against where I came from. It was just simply people from that area just don't do that kind of stuff. So my kind of education of cinema came at a pretty young age. But once I realized that there were people that actually did this and they actually were normal people that came from normal places quite like I did, it kind of started to open up a world of possibilities. And that's when I started pretty much devising my plan to get into this world. And the only exposure that I really had as a kid was the Jacksonville International Film Festival, which actually recently we've been invited to the Amelia Island Film Festival in Fernandina Beach, Florida, to screen. They're going to help us. They're holding a fundraising event for us within their festival. And the Jacksonville Film Festival this year was actually dismembered. And the Amelia Island Festival is actually going to become the, you know, kind of premier festival in North Florida. But anyways, the Jacksonville Film Festival would hold seminars and screenings and all different kinds of stuff where people from the area could come and, you know, kind of be exposed to the film industry. And I did that for a couple years, and I just used to go and listen to lectures from different cinematographers and directors. And I figured, you know, I'd give it a shot when I could, and I did.
Do you know when that Jacksonville Festival or the Fernandina Festival is?
Yes, we're screening. I believe it starts February 27th through the 2nd of March, and the screening they're giving us two screen. We're the only film, I believe, that had to have two screenings. The first one is March 1st at 6 p.m., and the second is the next day, Sunday, March 2nd at 3 p.m. I believe.
Good deal. Now, Atit, tell us a little bit about yourself as well, and what led you to create entertainment there.
You know, I was born and raised in India, and I was there until I was 11, and I moved here to New York about 20 years ago, and sort of just had a pretty traditional upbringing and traditional undergraduate education. I went to George Washington University down in Washington, D.C., got my bachelor's in business administration, and right in my early years, a family member of mine had also gotten into film, so it gave me a little bit of exposure in film that way. But for me, I didn't really actually start doing it full time until 2011. Up until then, I was primarily working in product management. My last job was at a company called Thomson Reuters. And I was doing technology up until 2011 when I kind of just decided that I wanted to sort of do it full time. And so then for 6 months or 12 months, I sort of just did what most people without film background or experience in New York do, is just start sort of PAing and production managing and ADing sort of any job that I could find and any job that I could do. And I kept doing that until I met Ryan and I read The Projectionist and just felt like it was a phenomenal project. And Ryan had a lot of capability as a director and started production on my first feature.
Now, how do you guys both feel? Because both of you kind of grew up or not inside the system. You know, a lot of writers, directors, actors, they start in the system. You guys were nowhere near it. Neither one of you.
Yeah, well, I feel like that's actually an advantage that we have because no matter how hard we try, you know, when you really break it down to the core of what we are consumers. We're regular moviegoers. And I think at the core of what we're trying to do, it's kind of to create projects that appeal to the masses while also trying to figure out a way to, you know, to tell stories, much like The Projectionist, which is obviously a deeper, more substantial just a deeper and heavier film than most of the things that you would see out these days. But I think that really works to our advantage. Obviously, it means we've had to hustle a lot more than somebody who had inside access right from the start. However, you know, now that we kind of are getting to the place where we're getting, I don't think either one of us regret not really having a substantial leg in built in for us.
Well, let's talk about the movie a little bit, and we will talk about the campaign you guys are doing a little bit later, but right now I want to talk about the movie. The movie's called The Projectionist. The movie is finished. You've got it. You're trying to release it now. So what was the inspiration for the subject matter?
Well, I mean, obviously the kind of main theme of the film at this point is a soldier kind of battling his undiagnosed post-traumatic stress disorder upon arriving back home from war. However, when it started, you know, I knew that this was going to be my directorial debut. I knew that this was going to be the first kind of exposure of any kind that I was going to receive as a filmmaker. And I was absolutely infatuated with Taxi Driver. Among other films, however, it was something that I really just connected with. And I kind of became obsessed with the idea of making a modern-day Taxi Driver, if you will. You know, similar themes, whereas the taxi cab being an isolation, a metaphor for isolation and loneliness. I kind of saw those same parallels with a projection booth. And that's really where it started. And it, you know, evolved into something, you know, much bigger over the course of 2 years of writing. However, I just was absolutely in love with that film and kind of wanted to do something along those lines because I felt that there really hadn't been anything recently out there, you know, like that. Of that type of style and genre.
Like what sort of things have evolved in terms of, you know, where you started to where the finished product is? Like what did you add that you didn't think you were going to go that direction, but you ended up taking it that way?
Well, the film has a lot of, you know, kind of psychological elements to it as well. And at the beginning, it was pretty much just a story about a guy who came back from war who was working nights as a projectionist. It was almost kind of like a short film. And as I began to watch more and more films, I found myself being more and more inspired by different things that different filmmakers had done. And then I just kind of tried to put my own twist, you know, on my story. And I've never been afraid to admit that the premise or the starting point of this idea was very, very, very unoriginal. It was simply, I love Taxi Driver and I'd like to make a film similar to that. But through my own, you know, the years of my own execution through trying to make this film happen, it's become something completely original in the process. And even if I tried my hardest to duplicate what somebody else did, I couldn't. So I guess as far as the evolution of the project, it just, I really, really, really did something that a lot of young filmmakers, I feel, don't do. They're so excited to get out there and make their first film that they spend 5% of the process on the script, and then they spend the rest of their time and money and energy on the other parts of actually making it and editing it. And I really, really, really took my time, over 2 years actually, to build the script and make sure that we had a strong foundation. So at least we knew what was built on top of that foundation would, you know, have something strong beneath it.
Now, Atit, when he came to you with the script, what was it about it that kind of made you say, we've got to make this movie?
Well, it's actually funny. We had a very interesting encounter and an interesting way that we met. And I think a lot of older people might see it as very, very strange. But I think people sort of in the New York crowd won't see it as strange as it's about to sound. But I met Ryan through Craigslist. I saw an ad on Craigslist that said, looking for young, ambitious producer. And it said something along the lines of young director looking to make a first feature, have, you know, DP on board and have a couple of things. And I replied back and said, you know, I'd love to read the script. And I did. And there was just something about the project that just made me feel like it could really be something that would be special. And, you know, I knew that I always wanted to make, you know, my passion in 20, 30 years is to make big budget action sci-fi, you know, the types of movies that I love. But there was something just about this project that wouldn't let me go. And sort of just made me feel like it had to be my producer debut. That something, it was going to be something that really, I think, made a difference, made me feel different as a film producer, and made filmmakers in the future take me very seriously as a producer. So, yeah, there was just, it was that thriller in the genre. And then, of course, when I eventually met Ryan after I read the script and realized that he was a 21-year-old director who had never been on a movie set before in his life, it sort of took me by surprise, but it almost made it more so that I had to make this movie, because I was like, how does someone who's never sort of experienced the movie set life can write something what I thought was so brilliant?
Well, now this is an independent film, which obviously has advantages and disadvantages for working outside of the studio system. So my question, and it goes to either one of you, what has been the hardest thing about doing this independently, and what has been the most advantageous thing of doing it this way?
I'll start, and I'm sure Ryan will have stuff to add.
I think it'd be a good idea if Atit told you what the worst thing about doing it, and I told you the best thing about it.
Okay.
Well, the worst thing about doing it, and some might say the best thing, is the amount of time that it really took. And I think when it all came down to it, for me, the hardest thing has been trying to find a home for it, trying to find that distribution for it from a business perspective. It's just been extremely, extremely tough not to have A-list actor you can throw on a poster and, you know, a film be in black and white. It's like almost like distributors won't refuse to even watch the film, much less give it a chance to see what how the content is and how good the story is. And they're so concerned about, you know, how are they going to just be able to easily sell it? And that's been really frustrating in our experience, because I thought, you know, we took the time and the energy and the effort to tell what we thought was a pretty powerful story and a pretty powerful piece and a new and unique way that hopefully audiences would like, because it's something so different. But we found that, you know, it's the exact opposite when you're trying to find the distribution home. So that's sort of been the worst experience in terms of making it outside the studio system.
Yeah, I agree with him that the worst thing can also be the best thing. The worst thing that it took us as much time as it did, and the best thing is that it took us as much time as we did, you know, as it did, because we had practically no resources at our disposal. We had people, and we had to keep them motivated and inspired on a day-to-day basis without money, which is pretty hard to do at the end of the day. But yeah, I feel as strongly as I do about the film, or I'm behind the film as much as I do, because it was a very long process to get to the point to where we have the cut that we do today that we feel as positively about. But to me, the best thing about it was I got to do whatever I wanted to do in every aspect of this film. Obviously, it was a lot of it was a collaboration between me and other people. And obviously, Atit and I, every decision that we make, have huge amounts of discussions and debates back and forth. But for the most part, what you're seeing is a film by a 21-year-old director at the time who nobody ever told him that he had to do this or he had to do that. Every single decision that I made was mine at the end of the day. And I think that that's something pretty rare that you probably aren't going to see too much of, and I'll probably never have that opportunity as a filmmaker again. As I'm assuming that the projects, if I'm lucky enough to continue making films, will be bigger in size and scope. So generally, the amount of pressure that's put on me by other people to make decisions as a group or collectively, you know, that's probably going to get more and more strenuous as time goes by. But yeah, the best part was that we had time, and I was, you know, we were really able to make the film that we wanted to make at the end of the day. And yes, it's taken a long time, but I think that's to be expected with the lack of resources that we had. But we figured out a way to make it happen, and here we are today talking about a finished film.
Mm-hmm. It came out great.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, it definitely had some really good performances in there. Russ Russo was fantastic as Jacob Nix, the troubled vet. And I mean, honestly, his performance is the one note the film cannot miss a beat on. So was it a previous piece that he had done that caught your attention, or was it maybe just a strong audition?
Well, this is a very interesting story. I'll kind of set it up and then I'll let a T take it from there. But kind of how he and Russ met was quite serendipitous in itself. And everything that kind of led up to Russ getting the phone call of, you know, virtually Ateet saying, look, I got this little indie film and I want you here for it. And he read the script, and ultimately, go ahead, Ateet, tell him the story, because it's actually quite funny.
Yeah, I mean, we met, Russ and I met in Cannes when he bummed a cigarette off of me. sitting on the phone. Him and I,
what year was that?
Was probably 2007 or 2008. It was quite a while back before we actually started making The Projectionist. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, Russ and I sort of, you know, once you bum a smoke off somebody and you start chalking, all of a sudden you're friends for that whole weekend. So, you know, Russ and I ended up having a good time that whole week, stayed in touch, really never talked about work or film or movies, but just kept each other in each other's lives. And, you know, I had a really good sense from him of the type of work he wanted to do. And he is, like you said, he is a phenomenal, phenomenal actor. And so he's been very selective over his roles. And, you know, I kind of knew what he liked and knew what he wanted to do. He wanted a piece that was 90% about one character, that made one character go through a lot of shit and shine. And when I read The Projectionist and I found out from Ryan that he had, you know, an actor in place, but an actor that he wasn't too confident about, an actor who was a friend of his, and he told me that, you know, Ateet, if you're going to start producing this, I'd love for you to help me, you know, rework everything from the budget
film,
on.
The film just became just when Ateet came on board, it was a completely different level of everything. And I said, you know, I have somebody, and I did feel confident in this person with the level of that the project was at that time. However, it was growing as exponentially on a day-to-day basis. And from there, I knew that with the other actors that we were talking about getting in supporting roles, we had to bring a lead on who could carry this film.
Yeah. And then I when he told me yes, I showed him a picture of Russ. He said, oh my God, that's exactly how I've always pictured Jacob. Can you send him the script? I said, sure. I sent Russ the script, and he called me 3 hours after I sent him the script, literally with almost tears in his eyes, and said, bro, I can't believe you found this project for me. I will essentially give my left leg to do this role.
And what a change he did, because, I mean, if you look at his stills on IMDb or anything else, I mean, he's got this long, wavy hair. He almost looks like he should be in Lord of the Rings or something.
And it's funny because we actually had a screening of about 300 people, a private cast, crew, friends, family screening last year. And I've had people since then say, you know, it would have been really nice if you had your lead actor come to this screening. And I said, well, what do you mean? He was sitting right next to me the whole time. I've never seen a human being be able to transform themselves on a monthly basis like Russ does. I mean, he can grow a whole head of hair in 2 months, and then he's playing a skinhead the next or whatever. Yeah, so, I mean, if you look at his IMDb page, you see how he transforms himself. And he's not only able to do that physically, he's able to do that mentally and emotionally, which is something quite rare. Everything I see of his, even though I know him personally, I'm completely sold on the fact that he is who he's playing.
And he's got he can definitely grow a fantastic porn stash, too. So that's that's one hell of a skill. You kind of mentioned the supporting cast a minute ago. You really kind of lucked out with this group. I mean, fantastic, you know, performances by Natasha Alam, Dougie Doug, Joseph Ganascoli, I believe it is.
Yep.
most people probably remember from, I think, Sopranos and stuff like that. So
yeah, he played a character named Vito who was in about 40-something episodes in The Sopranos.
How did you guys end up with this cast?
You know, it was one of those, again, it's one of those just serendipitous things. So Russ knew Natasha, suggested her for the role. That's how Natasha came on board. I knew Dougie Doug personally because I had shot a short film in his house in Brooklyn before. And it was funny because I sent him I told Ryan that, you know, what do you think about Dougie Doug for Marlon's character? And at that time, I was also friends with – I had done a short film with Sean Lennon, John Lennon's son. And so we were actually in talks with Sean Lennon, and Sean Lennon was supposed to play Marlon's role.
Oh, wow. That is a mind twist.
Very, very interesting, yes. And actually, Sean Lennon, when he wrote back about the film, he had just had nothing but good things to say about the script. And then he even at some point suggested that he would love to do the score. But – you know,
yeah, he agreed. He agreed to do the film. He wanted to do it, and I guess we'll tap on this later. But we had an opportunity to shoot on a camera, which we had no business shooting on, and the rental house agreed to give it to us if we pushed our filming back 3 weeks. And when we pushed the filming back, it pushed our schedule back to where Sean was committed to something else. So at that point, that was when Atiyah had sent Dougie Doug the script kind of for his opinion. And Doug said, I love this. I want in. And it was almost like him, Atiyah and I looking at each other being like, okay, Dougie Doug wants to do our movie, yet we do not have a part for him. We've got to figure something out. So it actually, you know, worked out to where when Sean fell through scheduling wise, we were then able to contact Doug, and nothing against Sean by any means, but I couldn't imagine anybody else in the world playing the role of Marlon like Doug did.
He did it so well, too. Honestly, you know, everybody knows him from Cool Runnings and that sort of thing, so I think you go in, as soon as I saw his name, I'm like, well, he's going to be funny, but I didn't picture where he would fit in the scope of the movie, but he did a great job.
Well, we were able to utilize him in a way in which he has been utilized before, but he is the comic relief of this film. And it's funny to even say that there's any comedic relief in this movie because it's pretty heavy. however, the couple times that you do kind of laugh and snicker a little bit, it's coming from Doug, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. So, and a lot of that was improvised. I would love, you know, when we screen the film and we're sitting amongst 200 people and they laugh at when Doug says something, I would love to be able to take credit for writing all of that stuff. Some of it I did. However, between his delivery and his improv, I mean, a lot of that's coming from him. And it was really important to get some sort of, I guess, levity, if there is any at all, in that script, because there's only a couple brief moments in the entire piece to where you actually, you know, kind of laugh.
And Ilham, she's someone I had never seen before. And, you know, we watch a lot of movies, you know, for the show and for the site. She took me completely by surprise. That she is an actress I would love to follow. She just seems like she has so much to bring to the screen that she just left on the table even.
She does. You know, the role that I had written, obviously, like Atiyah just mentioned, you know, I Russ put us in contact with her, and she was a little skeptical at the beginning. I mean, she really liked the project, but she was a little skeptical because at that time, you know, she was coming off of doing some substantial television roles, and I think some great things were happening for her. And when you hear that the director's 21 years old and never done anything before, there's no body of work to show, mm-hmm. you know, somebody on the rise, you know, naturally they're going to question, well, you know, I need to make sure that this is the right fit for me. So I flew to LA and I met with her, and within 5 minutes we knew that it was just going to be a great situation, and she was totally on board. But I did not edit that role to fit who we cast. That is exactly how it was written. And once again, just like I said with Doug, it's hard to imagine anybody playing that role like she did. It's still to this day, you know, I've seen probably, you know, 100 movies since I've made that film. However, I still have not found an actress that I thought could have played the role better than she did.
Very nice. Now, Ryan, the direction is really tricky. You bookend the film in color, but the movie's primarily shot in black and white, and it kind of almost feels like a noir film, especially with the audio cues. Great score, by the way. We'll, you know, we can talk about that in a second. But shooting it, for me personally, that way is a real risk because it can come across as gimmicky if you have someone that doesn't have the talent to do it right. Something I think you completely captured, and I'm not just saying that because we're interviewing you. I really believe you shot it great. So I want to know, tell us a little bit why you chose to shoot it that way.
Well, to be completely honest, I mean, I love film noir, and I love film from the 40s and 50s, kind of into that color transitional period where they were still shooting black and white by choice. But when all of this started, I was kind of looking at, you know, who do I want to be as a filmmaker, and how did those people get to where I'd like to be? And the two kind of biggest inspirations for me, not necessarily that they're my favorite filmmakers, just I'd love to be where they are currently, is Christopher Nolan and Darren Aronofsky. And both of their directorial debuts were very low budget, black and white, gritty films. So obviously, like I said, the project at the very beginning was going to be, you know, it already was a SAG, you know, ultra low budget indie film. However, it was going to be, you know, even smaller than that before I had met Atit. So, you know, I really thought that it would be easier to kind of create this landscape that I wanted to create, or that I had in my mind, with less money in black and white. I think there's a lot of things that work to your advantage if you do that. However, as the project started, you know, quickly becoming more legitimate than it previously was, I started really being able to sit with my cinematographer, Nicholas Canton, who had been with me from the very beginning of the process before I had even written the script. And at that point, we actually were able to watch films together and say, not only would we like the film to look like this or that, but we actually can duplicate that. But yeah, it was Chris Nolan's Following, which I think he made for around $6,000 in around 1997 or 1998. And it was Darren Aronofsky's Pi that I believe he made in 1998 or 1999. Those were the two films that really convinced me to do a black and white movie. And obviously when I met Atit, he was not begging me, but he was like, are you sure we can't do this in color? You know, it'd be much easier to sell. I love your story. I love everything. But is there a way to make it in color, the way we can make it work? And I just couldn't pull away from the black and white film noir aspects that I wanted to duplicate from movies that I had seen that I had just loved and couldn't forget, you know?
What made you decide to go with the score that you went with? Because I think that it's not overwhelming. It's not consistently throughout the movie. It seems to be part of the story, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. I think it's a companion piece to the story. You know, you see a movie with a Hans Zimmer score, and it's, you better have some amazingly powerful images if you're going to be on screen with anything that Hans Zimmer does. And luckily, you know, studio films with $150 million budgets can do that. However, ours was very different in the sense that, you know, we had to look at what we had visually and pair it with something that was effective, but almost, you know, in a subtle sense that was very under the radar. It worked, and you can't have the movie without it. However, Spyros Poulos is my composer. This was the first feature that he had ever composed. And Spyros is like an audio genius. I mean, he's amazingly talented. But we kind of went through this experience together because he had only done short films. And there's a huge difference between scoring a short and scoring a feature.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, scoring a short, you can kind of strategically place some pieces and just make it work. Scoring a feature, you're having to tell a narrative audibly along with the visuals, and it's incredibly tricky, and I give him all the credit in the world. And yeah, it was one of those things. We sat and we listened to a lot of music and a lot of film scores, and then we said, let's do it. And we did it together. I was there for pretty much all of the process. And that process of scoring the film for me was one of the memories that I really, really, really look back on fondly, and being able to do that with him. And I'm so glad that you guys mentioned it, because to date, the other reviews that we had, nobody has really mentioned the music, and I think it's definitely one of our strong points.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Wow.
Nobody has. I mean, you guys, I believe you said it was one of the more memorable scores to date, and yeah. I absolutely agree. I think it was done. I think it was done to the point to where it's kind of hard not to notice it.
It's like another character in the story.
It is, absolutely, and I don't mean to keep making this a reoccurring theme, but I really couldn't imagine anybody but Spyros doing the score at this point. And that's a good feeling to have at the end of the day.
Well, I'm just sorry that reviewers that have done it aren't paying attention, because that's a great score. And it really adds to the movie. It really did. And there's several scenes where I think it made the scene.
To be honest with you, I don't necessarily think that it's anything. I don't feel that it's anything against other reviewers. I think it's really hard to do a really, really good score or anything in that matter, whether it be a supporting performance or whatever, I think it's going to be really, really, really hard to grab the attentions away from Russ Russo playing the lead, because his performance is pretty much what you leave with at the end of the film is a lasting kind of, you know, kind of the lasting impression. It's him. It's really, really hard to upstage him. However, I'm really glad that you guys are noticing all of these other companion pieces to Russ's performance, because they're all just as important at the end of the day.
Absolutely. And Atit, Mr. Producer, tell us about the release strategy. I mean, unlike numerous Kickstarter campaigns, and there's a lot of them out there, your movie is finished. Your movie's done. You're not trying to get money to make a movie. You're not trying to get money to, you know, hold it hostage like some Kickstarter campaigns. You know, give us the money, maybe we'll make the movie. You've made it. You're using Kickstarter to try to release the movie in as wide a margin as possible. So tell us about that.
Yeah, so this was sort of my first experience going through the movie selling process, and even though I'd worked on so many in my life, going through this process, like I mentioned, you know, was probably the most difficult part of our process. So, you know, we've had the film done for a number of months now, and we started fielding some distribution offers, and, you know, we got some fairly decent offers from some companies that, you know, had a track record and had been in business for decades, and I won't mention any names, but, you know, for us, we just kind of felt like our film was a bit more special than the companies that sort of wanted to handle it. Because a lot of times we would go to these distribution companies' posters, and I'm sure a lot of indie filmmakers can relate. You just go to their site and you see some of these posters and you're like, oh, God, this all looks so, so bad. And, you know, do we really want our film sort of to be just stacked up against this pile? And, you know that in the distribution method, all you hear is about films getting lost. No mm-hmm. one's spending anything on marketing and P&A these days for small independent films. And all this creative accounting that's apparently happening rampant in the distribution world, especially in the small and in the big game. So for us, it was looking at all of those factors and saying, you know, we don't have a good option right now. We'd always thought about using crowdfunding at some point within our strategy. We knew that there was all this low-hanging fruit in the world, the audience that we had built over the last couple of years, making the project, the actors talking about it, us getting all of our friends and family and investors excited about it. And we knew that the first thing a distribution company was going to do is just sort of promote it to our internal audience. And we were looking at, you know, selling DVDs to people and getting 50 to 80% just taken right off the top. Wow. And so for us, we just said, you know, why don't we look at actually waiting to use crowdfunding until we wanted to actually release the film? And we know that for a film to have a market in foreign territories, to be noticed in foreign markets, and that, you know, that's sort of where the crux of the money lies in film distribution, is really getting your handle on foreign distribution these days. So for us, it was like, well, why don't we just handle the U.S. stuff ourselves? You know, why don't we release it exclusively via Kickstarter? It's not technically a worldwide release because Kickstarter is not available to the world, because Amazon Payments is not available to the world. So mm-hmm. you limit it to 4 or 5 countries. You limit it to an exclusive audience that just cares about creative projects and actually loves to help people find a way to get there. And you know, for us, hey, you know, I'm sure they'd be just as interested for a project that they're helping take to a new level. And for the first time on Kickstarter, someone could get instant gratification. And for us, so we saw this opportunity as kind of just doing something we didn't really feel like was being done at all or enough. And that was using Kickstarter to release a film, to raise money, to do an independently run theatrical campaign, to increase your foreign value, to get New York Times reviews, to get Chicago Tribune reviews, to do the things that you need to do for a small independent film to succeed, to find your audience on your own, mm-hmm. and for the first time to give people on a crowdfunding platform instant gratification to the product that they're buying, and, you know, offer it to them, and therefore now start having user reviews and start having critic reviews and start doing all of those things ourselves, where we felt, you know, we're probably just as competent and definitely a lot more passionate than the companies that were hoping to rep the film at up until this point.
It's really an original idea. I really commend you guys on coming up with this.
But really quick to add, you know, guys, it's really as simple as this. I don't want anybody to think that we think that we're better than any small distribution company that is offering us any type of a deal. It is a dream for an independent filmmakers like us to actually receive any type of distribution offer whatsoever. We're very honored that the companies who have reached out to us have. We've had great correspondence. They've treated us very well and very respectfully. However, we're not dealing with an industry, or we're not dealing with a part of the process that's completely dependent on the quality of your film. We're dealing with looking at a piece of paper with some names on it and a synopsis and a log line and your cast list, and they're determining what the worth of your film is by not even watching it. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's as simple as this. We think enough about our film to not want to give the rights up financially or creatively or anything. We'd like to retain those rights. And I kind of equate it to book publishing. You know, as an author, if you were to write some sort of a book, you were very reliant on going to a publisher and convincing them to publish your book, because somebody was going to have to spend a large amount of money on the pages, on the binding, on the actual books, the shipping, the marketing, all that stuff. And that's why as an author, you needed a publisher, or else you weren't getting anywhere. And recently, with the kind of the rise of ebooks and everything, I mean, authors now are able to write books and get their work out there immediately. And the same thing's happening with film distribution. But when it becomes accessible to anybody, the market starts to become incredibly saturated. And that was our problem, was nobody would sit down and watch our film. Nobody would do anything whatsoever, but besides going beyond the topical kind of information that was there from our IMDb page. You guys are saying it yourselves. Mm-hmm. Amazing performances by amazing actors in this film. However, distribution companies are looking at how can we market this film simply by the names attached to it. And so Atit and I kind of took a step back and said, look, as he mentioned, this low-hanging fruit thing. This is an audience that we have that we have spent a lot of time and effort and energy into acquiring over the last 2 or 3 years. And the first thing, like he said, that a distribution company is going to do is they're going to come in and they're going to take your low-lying fruit. Oh, great. You guys have a built-in audience. Cool. Let's market to them first. And at the end of the day, you know, our dream was always to get distribution. And then we realized our dream is not to get distribution. Our dream is to get this film seen by as many people as possible. Mm-hmm. And we don't need the backing of a distribution company in order to do that. So using Kickstarter in a way in which has never been used before, pretty much to sum it up, if you make a contribution to our campaign, you instantly are sent through email a digital download of our film to where you're able to watch it instantly. And that has never been done before. And so far, we're having an incredible amount of success. And the support has been great by people, whether they want to contribute to our cause or whether they just want to see the movie. It doesn't matter. They're still contributing.
Well, there will be a link in the show notes for the campaign. So I want to encourage everybody. And Brian and I both did. I mean, we've already screened the movie, but we both mm-hmm. contributed. So I definitely want to recommend that. And you, like he said, you will get to see the movie. We're not getting any kickback, so trust me, it's genuine. Now, before we go,
thank you so much, both Aaron and Brian.
And I saw Brian Williams' name on the backer list, and I thought we were about to get invited to CBS Nightly News.
Yeah, I hate to be a dream killer there, but
so Brian, I'm very grateful that you guys have both not only took the time to sit. Watch the film, review the film, and interview us. But yeah, to anybody listening to this, both of these guys have personally made contributions, and we're incredibly grateful for that.
Well, it's just a matter of putting my money where my mouth is. So it's definitely believe in this movie, believe in what you guys are doing. You got my full support on this.
More importantly, I don't want to know where his mouth has been. Before we go, Ryan, and we'll ask both of you, but Ryan, first you, what do you have planned next, or what kind of movie would you like to do? Let's say this, let's talk history. This movie is in the can, you're done, you've released it, everything's said and done. What do you want to do next? What kind of movie would you like to do next?
Well, I know exactly what I'm doing next. I mean, the means in which we're going to get it made are probably just as, I don't know, everybody seems to think that this new Kickstarter idea that we've kind of created is this new revolution. We've been on Bloomberg Television. We've been written up by Business Week. The Producers Guild of America has written an article about us, IndieWire, simply about this idea. And I'm very interested in figuring out ways to get films financed moving in the future. My next project is a film. It's an ensemble piece about six different stories about the lives of six different people who were all affected by the July 7, 2005, two bombings in London.
Ooh.
So that is my next project. You know, it's a kind of human drama, if you will, I guess, kind of a humanistic drama.
It doesn't sound like a comedy, no.
It does. You know, I people have told me before that if I keep going down this depressing negative route, that by the time I'm 40, I'm going to be directing Dumb and Dumber 4, so we'll see.
Or you'll be Martin Scorsese, either way.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I'm planning on doing an ensemble piece moving forward because, to be quite honest with you, I had to spend 35 days of filming with Russ Russo every single day, and I'd like to make sure that I never get stuck with one person for 35 days ever again. So.
Same with you, Atit. What's next on your radar?
Whatever is on Ryan's radar is definitely always on my radar. We're planning on, you know, hopefully being a producer-director combo for a long, long time to come. But I'm also producing other films on the side. I just produced my second feature film. It's titled A Conspiracy on Jekyll Island, directed by a phenomenal director, also very young, 25 years old, living in Chicago, named Aaron Rappaport. He directed a film called Syrup with Amber Heard and Brittany Snow that came out last year, distributed by Magnolia.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, so we just wrapped a production on Conspiracy on Jekyll Island in Chicago in December. The project is in post-production right now. It's another ensemble piece like Ryan's next film. It is a banking thriller set around sort of the start of the Federal Reserve and this ragtag team coming together in 2017 to stop a future terror cyber attack against the United States. And it's a banking thriller. It stars John Leguizamo, Minnie Driver, Ed Westwick, Diana Agron, Anna Sophia Robb, Christopher McDonald, and Mary McCormick.
Wow.
So it has a pretty phenomenal cast, and we're really excited about finishing this edit process over the next couple of months, and we should have a cut of the film ready by early summer, and we're hoping to release the film in November, and if all things go well, we'd hopefully like to premiere at Toronto.
Very nice. And nice. Also, before we go, tell our audience one more time what they can do to either, obviously you can find the link will be in the show notes, but tell them how they can either find it or support the film. What can they do to help you?
Okay, there's two things that you can do. Number one is you can go to www.theprojectionistmovie.com, and then that will redirect you to our Kickstarter page. Our homepage right now is simply our Kickstarter page because every ounce of information that you could possibly need about our film, our campaign, is there. And in addition to that, you can go directly to Kickstarter and search for The Projectionist and view the page. And all of our links to all of the press that we've done so far, the national press that we've received, all of the reviews, including a great one I recommend by The Hollywood Outsider, is there as well. Yeah, that's where you can see us. And the biggest thing is this, you know, a lot of crowdfunding works. It's a fact. And I really do see the future of film financing being within the audience or coming from the audience. However, with this, we are the first project to where when you make a contribution to our film, you're not only helping us and our cause to finance our own theatrical distribution and get this film out to the world on different video on demand and streaming platforms, but also above everything, you get to see the film instantly, just like you guys did. You're sent a link to instantly see the film. So www.projectionistmovie.com or go to Kickstarter and search us, and that's the kind of landing spot where everything you would ever need to know about the movie is there.
Atit, anything you want to add?
I just encourage, you know, people after they watch the film, whether or not their thoughts are positive, negative, hateful, or lovable, we'd love people to sort of check us out on Facebook and Twitter and definitely hopefully leave us reviews on IMDb and Rotten Tomatoes, because we know that that's how, you know, the word of the film is going to continue to be getting spread. So not only do we want people to contribute to the campaign and obviously share it with their friends and family, but we'd love to hear their thoughts on the movie once they're done. And we're very responsive personally. So if someone writes something to us on Kickstarter or Facebook or Twitter, they will be hearing from Ryan or I directly.
Yes, it's coming directly towards us. Or to us, and we are responding to every inquiry directly.
I like how you encourage the hateful people to leave a message.
That's what we're going to do. If there's any hateful comments, we're going to come back and we're going to do another show with you guys, and we're going to deconstruct those hateful arguments and figure out some sort of way in which they're irrational and invalid. No, I'm just kidding. No, we welcome any comments or criticism whatsoever. And at times I get a little worried because the support has just been amazing. And I have heard a couple of negative things. However, for the most part, it's been overwhelmingly positive. So I anticipate, taking some blows or whatnot. But so far, it's been an amazing experience. And this is just the beginning. And I'm so glad that you, both of you, were able to be a part of this from the very beginning. And we're honored to have been on your show.
Oh, thanks for coming on, guys. And we want to wish both of you the best of luck with the release. I would not say it if I did not believe it. Brian probably would, but I would not. Well,
you're an ass.
It's true. But both of us, we were really surprised by it. You know, we see a lot of independent movies, and there's a lot, and I don't want to say bad, but there's a lot that aren't very good. It's nice when we can tell our audience, check this out. This is something you haven't seen before, or something original, or something different from what you're used to, especially in independent cinema. I'm just glad we could do whatever we could to help.
Well, thank you very much. And I guess in closing, my last word will be, we really didn't get to talk about our cause in regard to, we're very involved in the military community and day by day becoming more so involved, screening the film for veterans and trying to raise money towards raising awareness on post-traumatic stress disorder, soldier suicide, all of these things that are being swept under the rug and not talked about. So just know if there's anybody, going through any of these type of things, we're completely on your side and we're kind of sticking our necks on the line to talk about something that a lot of people aren't talking about because maybe they're scared to stand up. And, you know, we made this film ultimately for the people like Russ's character, like Jacob Nix, who have been affected by this. And that's going to, that's going to remain our number one priority moving forward.
I will tell you this in closing. My mother's been in psychology, her whole life. And I talked to her about the movie itself. And she said that PTSD, it can actually represent this form. And his descent. So, I respect that there is a level of honesty to it, too. It's not just all for dramatic effect.
Absolutely. It is, it's an extreme case. But at the same time, we don't know that for sure. We don't know who's going through this or what exactly they're going through. Mm-hmm. So, hopefully we are, hopefully you guys were entertained by the film. And also it left you with a kind of lasting impression of what somebody who could potentially be going through something like this is dealing with.
Well, thanks both of you for being on the show. We appreciate it.
Thank you guys
absolutely.
So much.
Thanks
hopefully
so much
talk
for
to you
us.
Soon.
Absolutely. And hopefully we'll be talking to you for the next movie.
Yes, for sure.
You guys will be the first ones.
All right.
Have a good evening, guys.
You too. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Remember, you can always email us any questions or thoughts you have on this episode to feedback@thehollywoodoutsider.com. That's feedback@thehollywoodoutsider.com. And you can hear a new episode of the show at thehollywoodoutsider.com, iTunes, or Stitcher Radio every Thursday. But make sure you check out The Projectionist at theprojectionistmovie.com. That's theprojectionistmovie.com. We think it's well worth your time. This is Aaron from The Hollywood Outsider saying thanks again for listening, guys. I always appreciate it for every episode you're listening to. And remember that the next time you head into a theater, buy popcorn.